Welcome, everyone. I come from Kelowna, and here it is again. It's raining here, right? So I'll live with that. It's probably going to rain there eventually, too. It's, of course, a lot drier, particular climate. I was very pleased to be able to be invited by the Creation Science Association of British Columbia to come and speak. It's become a passion of mine. I teach now at Okanagan College, but maybe you can tell by the more gray hairs in my head that I'm going to be retiring soon to be able to focus more on what is my passion. And that is to bring sort of the general idea of the science message, and in particular tonight, to be able to uphold the biblical truth about the history of the universe. And I find it a very fascinating topic, the one that was picked. I gave a sort of a selection, and this was the one that was chosen for here. So it is astronomy, so there's some physics kind of stuff in it. So when I see too many of the eyes going glassy, you know, I'll try to just go faster or something. I don't know. I'll worry about it when the time comes. So I apologize in advance for those of you that I may be speaking at too high a level for, and maybe I'll apologize also to those that I'm not at a high enough level for. It's always hard in an audience to be able to find that nice middle ground. I'm also a teacher, and I find that in my classroom. Don't they always tell you that, right? You're either going too fast or you're going too slow in the same class, right? So it seems like it's working, and that's good news right there. So I'm going to hit the next button, and if this works, I'm really happy. All right, I'm now happy again. Except I'm not totally happy. You see this over here? You're going to have to live with that for the whole presentation. So it happens once in a while, and it's just one of those things, but it's clear. Yes, astronomy in the Bible, upholding the biblical truth about the history of the universe. And I'd like to say that where I come from is that although the Bible is not a science text, that it is accurate in what it says when it interacts with history descriptions or things that have happened in the past. And I have some pictures here. First, the quote being, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament sheweth his handiwork," Psalm 19:1. And I believe that when we see images of things like Mars, these beautiful pictures they've gotten on Saturn. Is that showing pretty well there? Okay, Jupiter. It's going to get even more exciting here soon. The Helix Nebula. We have a Omega Swan Nebula. The gas is there. How about the Sombrero Galaxy? Fascinating. The eye of NGC 6751. A cluster star field. And look at this star field. Wow. And when I look at these and I think, wow, you know, that, as I started preparing for this, and then of course I can be like anybody, I can go to NASA website and they have these things, you can download these things, right? And I went up there and I thought, man, this is amazing. Look at the complexity that's out there. It looks like design. It's beautiful. I mean, we're sitting there going, wow, this is amazing. Now the question is, did that come about really by natural processes? But first of all, to give you an idea, they often say, let's discuss how big is this universe that we live in. And by the way, this last picture, the reason I've stopped on that one, is that you are seeing a very deep field image by the Hubble Space Telescope, and you're actually seeing galaxies in that, and how many of those are, each of these individuals here, that's actually a galaxy. That's probably a galaxy, all of these galaxies. I mean, well, that's pretty interesting. It looks like a blob of light. But to put it in perspective, right, we often talk about how fast light travels as a time, a distance indicator, or how, sort of doing a computation, I'll give it a second here. If you take light, and if I was to take a light beam and I just shot it around the Earth and I could make it go around the Earth, it turns out that I could probably make light go around the Earth 7 times in about a second. That's pretty fast, right? Wow, okay. So then how far, if I was able to travel that fast, how long would it take to, let's say, go to the sun? Because obviously we get a lot of our light from the sun. Well, it turns out it'd be pretty close to 9 minutes. Okay, that's not bad. So on the Earth, 7 times in a second, but 9 minutes to get to the sun. Well, let's go a little further out. What about the nearest known star, right, which is Alpha Centauri? Well, it would take light 4 years to get to that distance. So we're talking in the trillions of miles. How about going across the galaxy? You might correct me on this one. I think it's like well over 10,000 to 100,000 years. I think it's 10,000. I might be wrong. But the point is as we get further out, then we have galaxies and clusters of galaxies and superclusters of galaxies. So they estimate that there are 100 billion galaxies in the whole universe, each of which could contain, on average, 100 billion stars. So 100 billion stars, Each galaxy, 100 billion galaxies. How far out does it go? Well, the limits of our detection are getting into the order of 10 billion years it would take this light to travel from one end, from the center, if we define the center, we have center, but center to the outside edge. Right? 10 billion years. So it's huge, huge. And when I think of that, I think, that shows to me the glory of God. When I look at that, I don't see naturalistic processes, random chance, cosmological happenings that created it, or made it. I think of God the Creator. And of course, I don't know how many of you are like this, but I'm the type, I don't know why this, I like to go outside at night and just look up there. You know, and you can see sometimes the way of the Milky Way. Sometimes you'll see the odd meteorite, you know, shooting star come by. And then you can sort of, with the power of the telescopes we had, it's like, almost like God was so much bigger than us, it took us this long to find out a way to even look at it. Whichever way you want to see that. Now, here's where we go to the science part of the day. For the topics today, what we're going to look at is, first of all, what are the two basic models that we can look at for describing the universe and how it came about? We're going to look for evidence of age. Is the universe really that old, or is it not? How about the origin of stars? Is there a good naturalistic explanation with known physical laws to be able to produce the stars that we see? What about this thing called the Big Bang cosmology? And lastly, if we get time, we may talk a little bit about distant starlight and how there's a problem there for creationists, and in a sense there was for cosmologists as well. Back to the two models here. Did it actually work? Did it highlight? Yeah. It doesn't do it on my screen, you see. It just shows it on yours. Do you see that little... We're all supposed to appreciate how much work I do. So we're going to talk about the two models. Well, here we have it. We have, first of all, what we call, I'll use the term, cosmological evolution. And this one will be the sort of most commonly accepted paradigm within the scientific community about how the universe came into existence. It may also be thought of it from a Christian context, as some people believe as a theistic type of evolution. In other words, somehow God maybe started the process and then it kind of ran on its own. Right? So we call that, I call them one and the same. Why? They both believe in the sort of Big Bang standard model filter now. They believe the universe is between 12 and 15 billion years. I believe they're around 13.7 billion years old, I think it is at this point. They believe in stellar formation, the formation of the stars, has to be a natural process, that we can account for it by natural processes only. We don't have to invoke a divine power. The biblical model, on the other hand, which is what I espouse to, is that God spoke the universe into existence, as it tells us in Genesis chapter 1. I believe the universe is a young universe, and by young, I'm going to go in the order of several thousand years. Certainly not millions and billions of years. And I say young universe by Earth standard time, right? Because the Bible is written according to what when Adam was around and talks about the 6 days, and that's Earth standard time. And I have to put that in there on purpose. And of course, God created the stars. They didn't come about by naturalistic processes. Well, we have a little picture here that shows us two beginnings, two possibilities. On the top row, we have sort of the standard Big Bang framework. We have the idea that some big bang occurred at a singularity, it was called, back about 15 billion years ago, approximately, these are approximate. 10 billion years ago, which is 5 billion years later, we started to form a lot of the stars, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. Then we have the sun, which is believed to be formed 5 billion years ago, the earth about 4.5 billion years. And then, of course, we have our first oceans at 3.8 billion years. Noticing contrast, what that shows and tells us compared to what it tells us in Genesis chapter 1, which is very straightforward about what it says. It tells us from days 1 and 2 that basically in that time God creates, of course, the light. He creates matter, the time and the universe. We call it the beginning of time, matter, and space. He creates light. He creates the ball of water, and then he separates the waters above and below, it tells us. Day 1 and day 2 that occurs. It isn't in day 3 that we actually get dry land and plants. By day 4, notice it's day 4, and when I'm talking about these days, I mean 24-hour solar days, approximately 24-hour solar days. And for some, that's a hard thing to get around. Day 4, sun, moon, and stars. Day 5, We get the sea and the flying creatures created. And then, of course, we get the land animals and man by day six. By the way, notice there are some serious problems if you want to believe in long ages. For example, you got to be able to count for plants being around before the suns. But then again, I always say, wait a minute, I don't have a big issue with that. First of all, number one, it said that the Holy Spirit hovered, so it could have been that light was already present. Secondly, I'm sure plants could survive 24 hours without some sunlight before they come about. So I'm not going to get in detail of that. That can be a big discussion, and you may have some better ideas than even I do on that. All right, so certainly two different ideas about what we have from beginnings. I think we also end up, though, from those two different futures involved. What will happen in time? Well, if you take the Big Bang model, and over billions of years, what's going to happen? It's this thing called a heat death. Because everything happens in such long time frames, eventually, for example, the sun will burn up its energy. The stars will burn up their energy. And pretty soon we'll end up with this universe where all the heat energy has been dispersed. So they call that a heat death. On the other hand, when we look at the biblical future, we have a 6-day creation that happened thousands of years ago. And for some, if you want a date, maybe approximately 4,000 BC. I don't mind hanging around that date. For now, it's not bad. It's close to that, I believe. That's what the scripture tells us. All right. So for thousands of years, what do we have? We have the reign of sin and death because of the fall of Adam, and he disobeyed God. And then we have this corruption that happens within the universe, in this earth and in the universe, I believe. Then, of course, second book of Peter, chapter 3, it tells us that there will be again a new judgment by fire, where the elements will be burnt up, literally it says. And then we will have, of course, an eternity, which is described in Revelation. Two different things, totally, totally. Now, I have a question that I usually have to ask you. If you had to believe, and you wanted to believe, that things are actually millions of years old, you're a Christian, you believe in the Bible and what it says to be true in its readings, and I asked you, where do you fit the millions of years? Where would you do it? Well, you got a bit of a problem. Because if you look at Adam, and from Adam on, you have the genealogies listed in Scripture. That gives us a pretty good linear description all the way through into Abraham, and then from Abraham on to Christ and so on. And if you look at those, you can only put in thousands of years. Even if you considered a few missing parts, missing genealogies in there, you can't add a lot of time. So now you've got an issue. If it's Adam is there, where are you going to put it? Well, what usually happens is this. You end up getting it put and spread throughout the 6 days somehow of creation. Because after Adam here, there's day 1 to 6, after Adam, genealogies limit the time frame. So then you ended up with different ideas that came about since about the 1800s on, generally speaking. Well, I'm not the summer. I've never quite figured out what we would have before God said in the beginning. I don't know how we could get anything before that. But anyhow, maybe somebody has some idea. Certainly Genesis 1:1 to 1:2, there's what we call the gap theorists, and they have proposed that. I think it was Chalmers was the one that proposed in about 1850 or 1860. The idea that there's a sort of a separation in Genesis chapter 1:1 and 1:2 there. I won't get into it again in detail. And then, of course, others would simply spread the millions of years into the days. In other words, they believe that they're not days, they're ages of time. And therefore, they can be extremely long periods of time. And those you would probably include as both the progressive creationists and theistic evolutionists in that group. For me, again, I just simply say, well, we have the genealogies from day 6 on. The Bible is pretty clear about how they describe the days, the 24-hour days. It talks about evening and morning. So they have the ordinals associated with the word yom. In Hebrew, yom is the word for day. And I think that I think most people, if they just read it, especially give it to a younger person who hasn't been exposed to all kinds of other information, if they just read it, they will say, and you ask them, how long did it take God to create? And I think most people will say 6 days. Right? It's afterwards that we put our interpretations on that because we believe that science has proven that things are really old. And therefore, after the fact, I think, we do a bit of what we call eisegesis, right? Where we read our ideas into the scripture rather than being exegetical, bringing stuff out of the scripture in its plain reading. Can't remember what's next, so I have to hit the button there to tell them what to do next. All right, so what about evaluating the evidence? Well, certainly in most textbooks and science journals, we will certainly say that they promote the idea of the Big Bang, where everything's billions of years old. Matter of fact, they often use the idea of distant starlight, billions of years old, And just like that description I gave you, if stars are so far away, it literally takes light that long to get here, they say, well, how can it be any younger than that? And that's a question that we do have to answer as creationists. But are we being given all the evidence? And I think evidence against one position is support for the other position. So I'm talking two sides to this, right? I'm talking, we'll call it the standard cosmological view, usually the Big Bang, as opposed to a creationist view of how the universe came about. Before I do that, you ever seen this one? What do you see when you look at the picture? Now it's interesting, if you think about the picture, we all have that evidence in front of us right now, right? Every one of us, we see the same thing exactly. There's black and there's white, and there's some kind of image. Now, some of you have seen, how many first saw the saxophone player? How many first saw the lady? Oh, interesting, more saw the saxophone player. Okay, now how many have not seen both? Okay, keep looking at it for a bit. There's both of them sitting there. The saxophone player, of course, there's the end of the horns, there's his nose and his hair up there. Right? If the lady, there's her one eye, there's the other eye, and her nose there, and her mouth there. Right? So we have a young lady and a saxophone player. Interesting that, as an idea, I'm just giving this as an idea, we could have the same evidence. And yet, if I gave you one quick glance, and we both looked at it, and afterwards we had to gather evidence, I turned it off quickly and said, okay, I want everybody to know, what did you see? And some said, I saw a saxophone player, and the other person said, no way, there was a young woman there. And I'm going, oh, gee, well, we've got an argument going on, and well, it turns out you're both right. Now, I'm not saying in the view of what we're going to do in creation that we're both right, but I'm going to say that looking at the evidence can affect, by your previous viewpoint, by what you're looking through and how you look at things, you may look at the evidence, the same evidence, and see a different conclusion or get a different result. Here's another one. One more for you. All right, remember this one? Can you see the young woman or the old one? Old? I think the young one is harder at first. I'm not sure. Okay, how many... Okay, little time here. Okay, how many saw the young one first? How many saw the old one first? Oh, that's close to 50-50 there. Okay. And how many cannot see both yet? Yeah, if I have to tell you both, it gets tough, right? Well, the young woman, the best I can do is there's her eyelash, her nose, she's looking that way quite sharply. There's a feather in her hair up there. All right, and there's her hair. And there's her ear right there. And her chin right there. The old lady, she's looking more closer to at you. There's her two eyes, and her mouth is right here. Her big nose there. Amazing, eh? So it's just one of those things where I just use it as a way to say, I think that we can have in the situation of creation evolution, you can look at evidence and interpret it two different ways. Okay, so now I got a pitch for that. Sorry, I have to go on for this. Okay. So let's take scientific data. In this particular presentation, we're dealing with astronomical ideas. And so we have things like, you know, gaseous nebula, you know, maybe stars forming up in that little place right up there. Today even can have it happening, supposedly. And there's our evidence. We can all see that. We can look at the CBM, the cosmic microwave background radiation. We can all look at that. We can see this evidence as astronomers. But how do we interpret it? I believe it's going to happen like this. Generally speaking, if you assume long ages in evolution or naturalism, right, to begin with, I believe that you will come up and see that. Generally speaking, you will see naturalism at play. Personally, I find that hard, but some do. All right? If you assume creation, and I think, really, if you look through the biblical eyes, that you will come out seeing it differently, and you will indeed see that there is a creator out there. Although I'm still saying that most people, honest, when they look at those images, they have a hard time thinking that this came about by natural processes only. I think it does speak of creator. Okay, so our interpretation is certainly influenced by our assumptions and our biases. Well, what about the evidence of age? Did it get bigger and smaller already? No, it didn't. Did it not? Oh, there it goes. Look at this mess on there. Yeah. That's okay. Evidence of age. Well, if the universe is young, we should have some evidences that it indeed is young, as opposed to that it's very old in billions of years. What we look at quickly is the recession of the moon. There's actually a young age for the solar system argument. Origin of the moon itself. Still a lot of difficulty for the secular astronomers, astrophysicists to explain. Comets. Age of the sun. And so let's look at recession of the moon. All right, little physics time coming up here. Right. We know, of course, that the Earth pulls on the moon with the force of gravity, but of course the moon pulls back on the Earth also with that same force of gravity. We know that that by Newton's third law, I teach that quite regularly at my classes that I do. It's actually one of the harder laws to explain, the action-reaction law. Don't get on that one, okay? But we do know this, that friction by tides, so is slowing the Earth's rotation. Why do we get the Earth's tides? Well, it's because of the pull of the moon, right? And it's causing the Earth to lose some what we call angular momentum. It's spinning, it's slowing down. Now, if you take this, I'll show some other pictures better that might explain it. The law of conservation of angular momentum says that this loss must result in a gain by the moon. It means, in other words, it must speed up. If the Earth is slowing down a little bit, very slow on it, that the moon actually must be picking up speed. This causes the moon to accelerate in its orbit so that it slowly spirals away from the Earth at roughly 4 centimeters a year. Big deal, right? Well, actually, it is a big deal. Because remember, we're talking now, if you get the standard view of how old things are in our solar system, you're talking billions of years, right? They say that the Earth is about 4.52 billion years old. Okay, so let's take that into account now. Here's an image now that shows some idea. See, at the present rate, what we call our present-day recession rate, see, we have the idea of tidal bulges as the Earth rotates and then the moon is pulling on it, right? And therefore, the moon is very slowly starting to move away from the Earth, right? It's moving away. Now, if you go back in time, though, what will happen is the moon, then, if it's going away now, the moon must have been closer in the past. Okay, fair enough. If it was closer, of course, you'd end up with bigger tidal bulges and so on. But look at what happens to some of the math of this. Okay, let's go to the Earth-Moon distances now, and there's people that can do these calculations, they're not that hard. Well, 1,000 years ago, the moon was a whole 125 feet closer. For you in metric, I don't know what that is, what's that, divide by 3. Okay. Not that much difference. You say, well, who cares? So what? But now look at this. Now, 1 million years ago, long time frame, it would have to be about 28 miles closer. 10 million years ago, 284 miles closer. Look what's happening, eh? Now, go back 100 million years, it's all of a sudden 2,840 miles closer. I forgot the distance to the moon. Does anybody remember the miles?
254,000 miles.
Think of it. Yeah, it sounds close. 200,000, wasn't it? Very good. Yeah, so roughly that far. Okay, let's go back now a billion years. 28,400 miles, and then at 1.4 billion years, contact. Okay, question is, how then can you say that the Earth is 4.52 billion years if we take this very normal physics phenomenon, extrapolate it back into the past, do the math, and end up saying it can't be much older than a billion to 1.4 billion. I'm not saying it is that old. I'm just saying by their own assumptions that we've got a problem already. It can't be that old. So this little picture, for those who didn't catch that, shows here's the distance from the Earth this way, and then here's your, by the way, billions of years. They usually use G for billion instead, okay? So there's 1.4 in Earth today, and if the graphic works, okay, there it is. So that's what will happen. The moon, in the today, is that far away. That means in the past, it had to get much closer in an exponential fashion. So it puts a limit to how old the solar system must have been. Couldn't be 4.52 billion years, right? And yet they say that it is. Okay, they've had to find ways to try to explain this away. And I'm not saying they haven't tried. They have come up with things. The origin of the moon itself, it's a problem. It came up a whole about 4 different theories for this one. One is called the fission theory, and this is where the Earth simply spun so fast in the past that a chunk decided to blow off. Well, it has a lot of problems. First, the moon is chemically different than Earth. The Earth could never spin fast enough, and the escaping moon itself would break up. There's this thing called, I think it's called the Roche limit, where if bodies that are large objects of planets and so on get too close to each other, the gravitational pull will tend to rip each other apart. Okay, it's called the Roche limit. So that's why they're talking about the escaping moon itself would break up as it was trying to move away. So that one's no longer invoked. So then they had to change their idea, and they got the co-creation theory. And this one is basically, I think, also called the nebular hypothesis, I think it comes out to, and the accretion theory, that are the names. And this is the idea that from the debris that was left over from somewhere, probably a supernova in this one, the Earth and the Moon formed at the same time from debris that was orbiting the Sun. Right? Problem, again, the Earth and the Moon are chemically different, and it's unlikely the gravitation is strong enough to be able to actually cause that sort of dust stuff to come together. Well, the latest one, the one they like the most, I guess, is the impact theory. And this is where the material was blasted off from Earth by an impact of another object. Okay, so something's got to come nearby and be big. The impacting object would need to be twice as massive as Mars. That's big. Of course, we have no record for that, no idea where it came from, where we went. And of course, there's some sort of problems hanging in the metronome. Don't get that. Don't forget that. So it's difficult. As a matter of fact, this quote, again, by long agers, we'll call it, okay, Luzica and Taylor, Giant Impact and Fission Hypotheses for the Origin of the Moon, from International Geology Review 1998. And here's the quote. Let's keep it simple. The origin of the moon is still unresolved. We don't know how it happened. Right? So what's better to say? Well, maybe the best explanation is that the moon was created in its present orbit roughly 6,000 years ago. What's more unscientific? Either one. They're both faith issues in a way, right? We believe it because we have an eyewitness account, God, who's there and told us about it, or we have the idea of secular astronomy saying, no, it's got to come about naturally, so they try to extend away. Man, I'm in trouble. I got the glaze on some people's eyes already. It's only 5 minutes into the presentation almost. All right. How about comets? You know those things, right? There's the idea of showing the solar system here, and comets sort of orbiting and sort of sometimes long period orbits, a short period, we call them, around the sun. And they have that characteristic, you know, body, and then they have this long tail behind it. And some of you may have seen, you know, a couple of bright ones that were out there in the past, right? They weren't bad, I mean. And anyhow, so the idea is, well, that's very interesting. We've got to find out, well, where they come from. You see, there is an issue here. And I try to make a little graphic here. Notice how bright that guy looks when he's going around the sun. Watch him quickly. There he is. Oh, he's coming again. What happened to him? He looks smaller. He's dying. Why is that happening? Well, they believe that most comets have got this icy-type material. As you see that tail behind it, that's the material that's coming off of the comet, due to what they call solar wind effects and so on. So therefore, the comet is literally getting less material on it all the time. It's breaking up. So they can only last a certain amount of time. So they have an idea about how long these can last. As a matter of fact, I think the next image shows one that came by relatively recently. This is an amateur. There's one right there. It's just an amateur photography. Showing you go by the Ring Nebula by it. So this is the Swashman-Walkman 3 comet. That was, by the way, a fragment. It had split into three parts, and that's, one of the three fragments right there that they pictured. So they can even break apart in large chunks, not just necessarily have that tail where they're sort of constantly dissipating material. Question. They break down relatively quickly, right? Where do they come from? Well, what they did is they postulated this thing called an Oort cloud. Sorry that my voice keeps going in and out because I've got the lapel mic here. Okay, the Oort cloud. They proposed it because of this. If the solar system is billions of years old, then long-period comets simply shouldn't exist, of which we know about 500 at the time. There's 500 known long-period comets. Where do they come from? Because they wouldn't last billions of years. They would, as they orbit around, they might last a few millions of years. We need a source. Okay, here's your presupposition. It's billions of years old. Evidence tells me that we have these comets, but they don't last that long. What's the evidence? Well, we have comets that don't last that long. So the natural extrapolation might be to say, maybe things aren't that old. But no, instead, if you believe that, you've got to postulate something. And they did. They have an evolution model that says that we have this Oort cloud. Now, I don't know if you can feel this. There's the sun, and there's the planets. Okay? And way out, they see all this material here as part of the Oort cloud. Sounds good. Boy, there's a lot of stuff out there. And a lot of materials for which we can supposedly maybe knock a few out and they can head into orbit, you know, around the sun and we end up with comets. Not bad. By the way, there's also another one for short period comets called the Kuiper Belt. And that one is a little closer in here. There's the solar system, right? So the Kuiper Belt is sort of closer to our solar system. And by the way, if this is the whole Oort cloud, then the Kuiper Belt is that little part inside there. This all sounds good. Have they found it? Well, guess what? I don't think so. There's problems with the Oort cloud. First of all, it's never been observed.
It's too far out.
Yeah, it hasn't been observed. Have they found a little bit of stuff they might think is there? Yes. But you see, the belief system says, no, it's got to be there, therefore it has to be there. We just haven't got the evidence for it yet. And by the way, that's true. There is no evidence that it exists. It turns out that they think there's not enough mass in that hypothetical Oort cloud anyhow. So what do we end up with? Well, other than, by the way, the reason I showed this picture, there has been a few Kuiper Belt objects right here found, but the few that have been found are very large, Whereas comets are much smaller, like if their radius is 100 to 500 kilometers, these are typically 10 kilometers in distance across from comets. So they're not the right size anyhow. That's the Kuiper belt, not the big Oort cloud. Right? The Oort cloud? No, it's not there, I don't think. So de Jong, a PhD in physics, astronomy in the Bible in 2000, this is his quote. The existence of the Kuiper belt and the Oort cloud of comets has not been verified. Perhaps there is an alternative. The presence of comets may be evidence that the solar system is not as old as is often assumed. Another quote, Timothy Ferris, the whole shebang, a State of the Universe report, 1997. Though the Oort cloud has yet to be observed, the theory accounts so well for the distribution of comets' orbits that most astronomers today accept its existence. Belief system. Right? Definition of faith. An unquestioning belief that does not require proof or observation. Again, if they were honest about that and say, yes, it is a belief system. We believe it's out there. It's a belief. But don't tell me that you know it's out there, because that's what eventually it comes to us as.
So my question is, shown in the Kuiper belt there,
yeah.
The objects are 100 to 500 kilometers in the Kuiper belt.
The few that they found, yes,
okay.
That they've observed. But they were too big.
Quite small.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. I've read that up. It seemed they're too big, whereas normal comets are smaller. So it doesn't look like they're coming from there anyhow, is what I'm saying, getting at that point. All right, here's another quote. Many scientific papers are written each year about the Oort cloud, its properties, its origin, its evolution. Yet there is not yet a shred of direct observational evidence for its existence. I'll be admitted, there's been maybe some from there. Just a few little pieces of it. You know who said this? Little old Carl Sagan, right, in 1985. Quoted this from him. Well, I don't know. There's one more quote from Danny Faulkner, PhD in astronomy. This is our technical journal, creationist article. Since it cannot be detected, the Oort cloud is not a scientific concept. This is not bad science, but non-science, masquerading as science. The existence of comets is good evidence that the solar system is only a few thousand years old. And there we go. Let's talk about something new. The faint young sun paradox. Evidence for a young Earth. Well, here's what this one has to do with. We indeed have the sun sitting there. How does the sun get its energy? We believe it's due to fission-type reactions, a nuclear-style reaction that occurs thermonuclear in the core of the sun. Now, the problem is, as it burns up its nuclear fuel, what will happen is the sun's core would actually shrink, making it hotter. Okay? So, therefore, what we're going to say is that the sun should shine more brightly as it ages, which we believe. That's the physics of it. Okay? So, I think I even have a little thing happen. So, the energy is by thermonuclear fusion they talk about. The core of the sun should alter, and the sun should grow brighter with age. So if the sun is 4.6 billion years old, it should have brightened by about 40%. So for those of us that can't read, I make the picture get bigger. So we have the 40% now bigger, brighter sun. Okay, now let's think about that. So it's brighter now by 40% than in the past, if it's supposedly 4.6 billion years old. Now remember, the Earth was formed roughly 4.6 billion years ago, and we happen to have oceans and first life, maybe about, they say, maybe 3.6 billion years. That's their hypothesis in evolution. Okay, if the Earth's average temperature right now is about 15 degrees C overall, whole Earth, all right, the brightness in the sun has caused a 25% increase in brightness in the sun, increases the average temperature by about 18 degrees. Do the math, subtract. 15 minus 18 is negative 3 degrees C. That means the average temperature on Earth, when life is supposed to get started, was freezing. Everything would be frozen. It's minus 3 as an average temperature. So therefore, is there evidence for that? No, most evidence shows that the Earth was maybe warmer in the past, not colder, if you look at their evidence. Of course, they come up with, you know how they try to fix this one, is they say the CO2 content of the atmosphere was much, much more in the past. Trouble is, they can't get near the right amount. It's there. So it still is a paradox. It still is something that cannot be explained. The sun. Galaxy formation. Here's a couple of pictures of some whirlpool-style galaxies. Have any photos? There's sure a lot of them. But say, go to NASA website. There's just some fantastic photographs there. What's this thing called the winding up dilemma? Oh, it's actually spinning. There you go. Now, what do I say there? Well, if you look at a galaxy, those little spiral arms, no, I know, it's a terrible picture. Sorry, it's the best I could do, right? But it's supposedly a galaxy. It's supposed to represent the spiral arms of the galaxy. And what we're saying is that the center of the galaxy, we know, rotates faster than the outside edge of the galaxy arms. Now, these are big, these galaxies, remember. They're huge, but this we know happens. But we also know that by the physics, if you spin this thing, eventually the arms disappear and it will become a blurred disk, supposedly within a few hundred million years. Now, remember, a few hundred million years, the universe is supposedly billions of years old. So the question is, which is the next slide tells us, Russ Humphreys, he's a creationist. If the stars of our own galaxy, the Milky Way, rotate about the galactic center with different speeds, the inner ones rotating faster than the outer ones, the observed rotation speeds are so fast that if our galaxy were more than a few hundred million years old, it would be a featureless disk of stars instead of its present spiral shape. So that means we have to limit. They can't be right. How can it be billions of years old? Because of this phenomenon. How about the formation of those galaxies itself? Here's a quote from Joseph Silk in The Big Bang, 2001. How did the galaxies themselves come about? Well, many aspects of the evolution of galaxies cannot yet be determined with any certainty. I'm glad he says that. I mean, that's good. But does this come out? For those of you that hear things about the Big Bang and how it accounts for everything, do you hear this? No. Do you hear it in textbooks? No. But it's true. At least he's being sort of honest, right? This is the Facts on File Dictionary of Astronomy. Galaxies must have condensed out of the gases expanding from the Big Bang. Details of the formation of galaxies are still highly uncertain, as is their subsequent evolution. So even how we got those nice spiral arms, how come they form in clumps like they did? We still don't know. So to me, it becomes then less, any more scientific, as I say here. Why is it any more scientific than in the beginning God created? Both faith issues. Wow. By the way, they also got a little problem. That those nice little spiral arms, they're finding them in galaxies. Remember that first picture I stopped at that showed the galaxies? I said the deep field pictures by Hubble, and I showed those little galaxies there. The trouble is, those are what they call finely, highly structured galaxies, and they're supposedly way back where the beginning, near the Big Bang, within a few million years, of the Big Bang occurred. And they're too structured already. They shouldn't be there. So they got a problem on both ends. Number one, they're getting these galaxies that actually do have the spiral arms too early near the Big Bang, according to the evidence. And on the other hand, they're finding there's a lot of them that have spiral arms now that shouldn't have the spiral arms if they're indeed many, many billions of years old. They're sort of fighting it at both ends, which is interesting. Maybe not interesting. Did anybody find that interesting out there?
Yes.
No. You're a good audience. You're being humorous with me. I'm sort of funny. I could tell jokes, but that's not part of this presentation. I have some good ones in other presentations about this. The reason I'm doing that is because I can't remember where I'm at. Origin of stars, right, okay. Origin of stars. Okay, two ideas. Cosmological evolution. Stars evolved billions of years before the Earth. Standard Big Bang concepts. Theistic evolution or progressive creationists would say, stars evolved billions of years before the Earth. Same thing. On the other hand, the Bible tells us, the Earth was created on day one, the sun, moon, and stars on day four. Remember how that goes, right? Big Bang tells us that we have stars evolving well before the formation of the Earth. The Bible actually has it the other way around. Earth material was on day one, not the sun, moon, and stars until day four. They're quite different. Here's a quote by Hugh Ross. Now, Hugh Ross, there may be somebody here in the audience. He's the sort of, I guess, more the head of Reasons to Believe. And he's a Christian, and he believes in a sort of progressive creation idea. He believes in long ages. And there's some other issues, I think, that he gets into that I don't agree with at all. But he believes in long ages. So here's a quote by Hugh Ross. The entire process of stellar evolution, stars, remember, evolution, is by natural processes alone. We do not have to invoke divine intervention at any stage in the history of the life cycle of the stars that we observe. His statement is saying what? God started, I say that. God started, but after that, it all happened on its own. All the stars came about by natural processes. Really. Okay? Is this statement consistent with the Bible? Alright, now here you're a good Bible church. Let's see what we got here. Genesis 1:16. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night, and, well, he made the stars also. It's almost like an afterthought, you know, afterthought. Well, but you know, it's pretty big. He's able to do that. It's there. Now, did that say, sound like the stars came about through naturalistic processes? No. It says he made them. He spoke them into existence, right? Isaiah chapter 40, verse 26. Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who hath created these things, that bringeth out their host by number. Host being the stars of heaven. Psalm chapter 8, verse 3. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained. Naturalistic? Stellar evolution? Really? Exodus chapter 20, verse 11. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. Psalm 33, verse 6. By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them. Psalm 148. For he commanded, and they were created. Wow. Okay, you get the point, right? I, even my hands, have stretched up the heavens, and all their host have I commanded, Isaiah 45, and Nehemiah 9:6. Thou, even thou, art Lord alone. Thou hast made the heaven of heavens, with all their host. Within the New Testament, we have John 1, verse 3. All things were made by him, through Jesus. Revelations 4. For thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. My question is then, is stellar formation by natural processes compatible with Scripture? And of course, we'll have to say no. It is by the word of the Lord that this universe and the stars were created. So again, I don't mind, you can believe what you want to believe, but we can't say that it's biblically consistent to me to have stars being naturally made over hundreds of millions of years, billions of years in the past. All right? Okay, what about this idea of star formation? Now we get a little bit of the physics part again. Okay, the book's happening already. The popular theory is that the stars form from vast clouds of gas and dust through gravitational contraction. Sounds good. Get all this huge debris out there, hydrogen and helium mostly, and then some of the other dust particles and heavy elements, and then to get enough of it, eventually, hey, just pull together, move, and get a star out of that deal. Well, there's a big problem though. If you get gas and dust clouds, they will not naturally contract. They will tend to want to expand. Part of the issues are, as they get closer together, there's more thermal energy implied by collisions, and as there's more thermal energy, it creates more temperature, more pressure than to keep it from collapsing. So they got a problem saying, how are we going to get the stuff to actually collapse? Now this is, I know, where I can really bog you down. It'll be interesting, I think I bring it up later. I'll get some quotes just to go through this. They try to explain this using other things, right? That how they can make it actually collapse. Let me go to the next slide first. Okay, Don DeYoung, PhD in physics, astronomy in the Bible. Quote, the complete birth of a star has never been observed. The principles of physics demand some special conditions for star formation and also for a long period, time period. A cloud of hydrogen gas must be compressed to a sufficiently small size so that gravity dominates. By the way, in the Big Bang model, very quickly in the Big Bang process, the first things that were formed and the only elements that were formed, they believe, in their own model, was hydrogen, which is the lightest of all our elements, right? Helium, which is the next one, and some of the next one, which is lithium. But mostly hydrogen and helium gases, right? They're very small. So he says, a cloud of hydrogen gas must be compressed to a sufficiently small size so that gravity dominates, so eventually gravity just simply keeps pulling it together, and voila, you end up with our sun. It's a population. One star or whatever. Okay, we'll get there. But it's the same idea. It's still a star. Okay, in space, however, almost every gas cloud is light years, huge in size, hundreds of times greater than the critical size needed for a stable star. As a result, outward gas pressures cause these clouds to spread out further, not contract. Lada and Shuv, the formation of sun-like stars. Despite numerous efforts, we have yet to directly observe the process of stellar formation. The origin of stars represents one of the fundamental, unsolved problems of contemporary astrophysics. I'll tell you, when I read the textbooks, that's not what they say. They come out more like this. Okay, the facts on file, Dictionary of Astronomy. Stars are formed by the gravitational collapse of cool, dense gas and dust clouds. Very authoritative sound. There are problems, however, this is Elise put this part, there are problems, however, in initiating the collapse of a gas cloud. True. It resists collapse because of, firstly, its internal motions and the heating effects of nearby stars, and secondly, the centrifugal spark due to rotation, and thirdly, the magnetic field pressure, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and on it goes. So what do we end up with? Well, the facts on file dictionary. In a massive dense cloud shielded by dust, it is believed that collapse can be triggered when the cloud is slowed on passing through the spiral density wave pattern of our galaxy. Anybody out there know what a spiral density wave pattern is? Shucks, I was hoping you'd tell me, because I don't know. I'm serious, I looked it up. It's hard to find that. Spiral density wave pattern. No, they're probably smart guys. There's one there, but I don't know what it is. Did I put that word underlined there? Yes. I like that word. It is believed. Yeah. I think that's a good way to state it. Well, they actually say, no, we can actually see stars being formed today. They actually say that. And here's one of them in the Eagle Nebula. And it's that nice, see these nice clouds here? There are different types of these, but generally there's a lot of hydrogen, there's a lot of helium, and then there's sort of different amounts of what they call dust materials. And anyways, they say up in these peaks up here that there's actually stars being formed today, which means there's gas clouds that are collapsing and eventually compressing enough that they produce stars. You understand what I'm saying? Like when you got this pile of hydrogen helium, you got to get it really compacted. You ever seen those little containers we use for, like they show gas containers, like for oxygen and so on that they have, you know, in those little metal steel cylinders? Well, they crank those things under unbelievable pressures in order to get, especially liquid helium, right, or liquid hydrogen. It's very, very extreme pressure required to do that. Well, they're saying this happened naturally out there, so what they got to do is they got to make such huge amounts of it come together that eventually there's enough gravitational pull, it's like getting squished, that it can push it together till eventually the hydrogen can actually interact, undergo a hydrogen bomb effect, and start to boom and fuse together and release tons of energy, like our sun, they believe, does not. Right? Now, of course, it's not like a bomb, it's a controlled kind of explosion, isn't it, the sun. It is an immense amount of energy involved. I hope that helps a little bit, right? So it's the idea of this contracting hydrogen and helium. We've got to get, got to do it. Well, here's an actual factor. Look at this quote, Martin Rees. Stars are still forming today. Really? You can actually observe that. About 1,500 light years away lies the Orion Nebula, enough gas and dust to make millions of stars. It even contains protostars that are still condensing. And then they came up with more accurate observations. Images taken by the European Southern Observatory Very Large Telescope in January of 2002 in the Horsehead Nebula in Orion verified that the structures are expanding. Well, that's what he thought. They're not. Right? So there's this big debate. Now they're saying, oh, yeah, they're expanding. Oh, no, you know, it's got to happen. Well, that's what you get. So you get the textbook's version, Prentice Hall Earth Sciences. A nebula is a large amount of gas and dust spread out in immense volume. All stars begin their lives as parts of nebula. Gravity can pull some of the gas and dust in a nebula together. The interacting cloud is then called a protostar. A star is born when the contracted gas and dust become so hot that nuclear fusion starts. Is this statement based on science or on a belief in evolution? I've got some conclusions here on star formation. Abraham Loeb. I think it's Loeb, I'm not sure. Harvard Center for Astrophysics. The truth is that we don't understand star formation at a fundamental level. Question, why do so many textbooks state we know how stars form? Right? It's a biased system. Now, sometime I'm going to have to get you back to this. You know that the real issue is, you notice I talked about hydrogen and helium? They say that after the Big Bang first started, they got these first ones had to form from only hydrogen and helium gas. That's all that was there. Nothing else was there. There was no dust. So the question is, you ever notice every one of those ones I quoted to you, they always talked about having dust around. Because when you look at our star night, it's got a lot of heavier elements in it and so on from this other stuff. They got a problem. We have never, ever observed what's called a population 3 star. That's one that only has hydrogen and helium in it. That's the one that supposedly has to happen after the Big Bang, okay? Population 3 stars, they call it. We can't observe one of them. There's none out there. As a matter of fact, they say, well, that's because they're already burnt up. They've already undergone supernovae, and they've already created the stuff, and now we get other stars from them. Wow. But you can't verify that. Nice story. But there's no population of three stars. So the question is, if we have trouble explaining with gas and dust and other galaxies around to influence gravity, so we might get this compression and formation of new stars, that's fine and dandy, but what do you do before you had galaxies? Before you had dust? And before you had the heavy elements of the early Big Bang? They can't explain it. So so for those of you wondering really more on that, that's where they're at. Maybe none of you do. Oh, you're okay? Good. Jeremy? I see some smiles. There's a few nodding off. I would be asleep too with some of this stuff. Big Bang cosmology. Yep, that's the most standard model out there today. There's some excellent quotes on this one. The handy space answer book. Here talks about the Big Bang. 15 to 20 billion years ago, a Big Bang or explosion occurred, creating the universe. The universe began as an infinitely dense, hot fireball, a scrambling of space and time. Okay? By the way, they now think about 13.7 billion years, but close enough. Infinitely dense, hot fireball, a scrambling of space and time. Okay. Now what happened? Well, sometime in the past then, they started with this original matter. Now that original matter, remember how big that universe was? Anybody know how big that original matter was according to the Big Bang cosmology? Tell me so I know. No. Anybody? About? Approximately? Yeah, some say smaller than an atom. It depends on the sort of theory. I'm talking an atom size. So, okay, let's be very generous and make it this big. Now, wasn't that movie Contact? I watched that. I go shows all the time. So I saw Contact, and they talked about other galaxies, and remember they ended up on galaxies within these little sizes? I'm thinking about the movie. Anyhow, can you imagine our universe starting that big? It's actually smaller, but that big. Cram everything there is today, make it that big. Now, here's what happens, though. Unfortunately, the contemporary modern, call it view of people that aren't in the know of it, think that it was an actual explosion. In other words, in all this vast empty space, there was this little particle and went boom. But that's not actually what the theory says. The theory says that it's both everything, space and matter, were in that little ball. There is no conceivable existence outside of it. I know, it's hard to visualize. I don't think you can. I don't know if I can't. I can't visualize that at all. All right, but anyhow, this original matter somehow underwent a Big Bang. When it did that, and I won't go into all the details, over billions of years, it eventually created what we see today, which is all those pictures I showed you, of all the different galaxies, the different planets, their tremendous variety, right? And they are very different. It's amazing how different they are, each one. So we ended up with this universe that they say has no center at all. By the way, it has no edge and no center. So those of you that are thinking of it as a big ball, you're in trouble. Because you'd be like the person, if only you could live on the ball and only experience 2D space and actually live on the surface of that sphere. I'm sorry, that's the way it is. And you would not even understand the idea that you couldn't go out and reach the edge of the universe, technically. Yeah. Because there's no edge to it. That's Big Bang we're talking about, right? Okay, so you've got a universe, they say, with no center, no edge, roughly the same distribution of galaxies and matter throughout this whole entity. Is everybody really clear on that one, right? That's a tough one. But I'm just telling you the truth. I mean, that's what they say, right? So it's not this explosion. All right, this is even better. I like some of the words in this one. According to www.bigbangtheory.com. According to the standard theory of the Big Bang, our universe sprang into existence as a singularity around 13.7 billion years ago. What is a singularity? Well, where does it come from? Well, to be honest, we don't know. Singularities are zones which defy our current understanding of physics. That means they violate our current laws of physics. Though they are thought to exist at the core of black holes, which we may have determined, black holes. You can't get inside a black hole. I think there's a movie out for that one. Okay, I saw too many movies that were there was one, I think, by Disney. I think one where you get sucked into a black hole or something. But I get to go to church and watch a movie, I guess. I look after it. So there are thought to exist for black holes. Now, singularity, the reason they say that, it's a one-time event. So you can't go back and redo it. So there's no way that we can verify this. There's no way. Right? You can't go back in time. Which brings me up to one little concept I'd like to mention. If I'm probably going over time, that's going to happen. If you look at our ideas here of, you know, what we want to believe, and suddenly I just lost it. It wasn't time. I'm blank. And I'm going to go on.
You can't go back in time.
Thank you. The operative, yes, there we go, thank you. Man, somebody was listening. The idea of operational science versus historical science. You see, we often get that idea that, look what science has done. And so, we put men on the moon, we've made computers, for better or for worse. You know, we've done all these fantastic technological achievements through science. When I go to the lab and I do my physics experiments, I can verify Newton's second law because I can repeat it and I can do it. We call that operational science. Stuff that I can deal with right now. I can verify it. Therefore, we have no objection ever as a creationist with operational science. Where we have an objection with is historical sciences. Where we go back to events that happened in the past that we cannot go back and redo them. We can't put them in a laboratory and verify it, right? So the Big Bang, although the Hadron Collider they're saying is they can't get close yet with the Hadron Collider, by the way. There's not enough energy in it. They talked about the Big Bang and worried about that.
Did they actually find the
boson particle? Boson Higgs particle? No. Are they back online yet? I think they're offline, aren't they?
Yeah.
Sorry,
a little side.
Yeah, they're offline. The problem's there. So anyhow, the problem is that we can't really go back and redo it. And the same happens for biological evolution, right? We can't go back and saw how a first living cell came about from non-living chemicals. You can't go back and redo that. We can't see how it happened. So we have issues when it comes to interpreting the past, right? But certainly not in terms of operational science. But often you're accused of not being, you know, good science. Which, well, yeah. Okay, it's Big Bang of Faith. Here's a further quote from this same source. Black holes are areas of intense gravitational pressure. The pressure is thought to be so intense that finite matter is actually squished into infinite density. A mathematical concept which truly boggles the mind, absolutely. These zones of infinite density are called singularities. Our universe is thought to have begun as an infinitesimally small, infinitely hot, infinitely dense something, a singularity. Where did it come from? We don't know. Why did it appear? We don't know. Sounds interesting to me. So it's a bit of a faith thing, right? It's they use fancy terms. How about a quantum fluctuation of nothing? And if you make it sound good. What's that?
Did these guys get Nobel Prizes?
Well, this is just what he was saying in this particular source. Yeah, but they're pretty smart guys, actually. But I think they just get off track in some things. But they're pretty smart. They're very smart people. Oh, boy. It's just because it was a cool picture. I kind of put it up there. I certainly won't go through the idea of, you know, there's the Big Bang starting, and there's billions of years going this way. And, you know, they got stuff happening back here. You know, they got this proposed inflation. Energy inflation, that's right. They got a little problem. Right? They had to, you know, sort of keep fixing the Big Bang. Because as they get new evidence, stuff contradicts it, so therefore they have to keep modifying and tweaking the theory. And one of the major ones done in the 70s was a problem with what's called the horizon problem, and they had to introduce this thing called inflation. Then they introduced inflation, and they got a problem because how can you get this inflation? As a matter of fact, the universe expanded so fast in that little ball, so quickly, that it was going way faster than the speed of light, or any event that we know of, which supposedly can't happen. The problem is then what turned off that inflationary epoch that we had to have? To explain these other problems. Then, of course, to have the inflationary epoch, we better put in dark matter. Now, what's dark matter? Well, we don't know, because it's not real matter that we have today. And so, therefore, we can't observe it. Well, maybe we're seeing it someplace, they say. But it's a problem, because when you really go back there, here's what they think the universe is made of, all right? Now, you go, okay, the universe. Well, heavy elements, 0.03%, fine. Neutrinos, whatever they are, 0.3%, they're actually very light, non-interacting particles. Okay. Stars, all of the stars only make up 0.5% of what's in the universe. Free hydrogen and helium, remember I said that's what the Big Bang started with, hydrogen and helium, the gases, 4%. Here we go. Dark matter, 25% of the universe, which we can't observe. And then the new one, dark energy, 70%. What's dark energy? I don't know. You can tell me. Dark energy, I read up on it. It's very esoteric kind of stuff. And anyhow, we got 95% of the stuff of the universe, the stuff we can't observe and can't see. Why? We need that to hold up the Big Bang. You have to have it there. It's got to be there. Now, dark energy, if anybody asks me, I think that's the one they're trying to use to explain that they think the universe is not just expanding now, getting bigger. They believe it's getting bigger all the time, right? It's actually accelerating a bit in the expansion. So this dark energy is the stuff that is causing it to spread apart faster. It's their idea, right? Okay, so it's kind of weird. I mean, when you look at this, and you kind of go, just on a superficial look at that, I'm not saying they're not smart, and it could be true, but just remember, there is no evidence for that stuff yet. Maybe some, circumstantial side evidences are implicating that might be some in this one little place. Well, no, we got to talk, 95% of the universe is made of this stuff, supposedly. Okay, it's not there. So therefore, what is the Big Bang? Well, it's based on what they call the cosmological or Copernican principle. What does it say? There's no special place in the universe. In other words, there's no center, which I mentioned. You can imagine the universe with no center. There's no place you can say, like, if you go over there, well, that's no more special than if you go this side or if you go this side, right? And the universe is homogeneous. That means it's roughly the same kind of stuff overall they talk about. Made up of the same stars and galaxies, roughly distributed over this universe. Paul Davies, quote, in his book, The Edge of Infinity, describes the Big Bang this way. The Big Bang represents the instantaneous suspension of physical laws. The sudden abrupt flash of lawlessness that allowed something to come out of nothing. It represents a true miracle. That's a good way of putting it. He didn't mean it in a biblical sense either, right? But it's true. Right? So why is this more scientific than in the beginning God created? Simple as that. Right? Now the Big Bang, I could quit right now, but I'm halfway through. No, I'm not quite, seriously. Let me get to a little bit more. How are you doing? Just kind of go a little more? Or should I quit? I can go farther. I do have more, but it is a problem. I knew this was going to happen a bit. This topic can just be that way. Just go on. The Big Bang, if you're really tired or something, you can fall asleep, you can leave, you can do whatever you like, okay, for a bit, and I'll keep going. Evidence used to support this Big Bang. Well, the big ones they use are what we call redshift. I'll talk about that in one moment, redshift. The other one is called the cosmic background radiation. That's a microwave radiation that comes from all over when we look around the universe. And then what we call the element abundances. And other evidence is used, and I had to throw this one in there, the education system and media, right? There's this different things that happen. Let's look at that cosmic microwave background radiation. There's been a recent probe that was sent out, and they look at this. They look up, and they look for all kinds of radiation that's out there, right? And one of these is called microwave radiation. And this was called the anisotropy probe. And what they did is they looked at the temperature in the sense of the universe. And they knew that it was very, very uniform. And so they wanted, this was a very accurate map of it. And by the way, it's like this. Those are the hotter spots and those are the cooler spots. And before you think there's too much there, those represent fractions of a degree in difference in temperature. They're not very much at all. It's very uniform in other words. Okay, and so they use that as evidence. And let me talk about that in a second. Now it's interesting though that we look at, well, what evidences would contradict the Big Bang? How about the first and second law of thermodynamics? I teach those. First law, energy can be neither created nor destroyed, but only transformed from one form to another. The Big Bang has to get energy from nothing. Energy, matter, universe, right? From nothing. So therefore, violate the first law. And the first law is a law. We know that. So okay, fine, but you're violating the law. The second law, we won't talk about that. Okay, how about this cosmic background radiation? Didn't I just say that was evidence for? Yeah, you know what? That radiation, now the universe is lumpy. It's got galaxies, right? It's got matter in clumps. A Big Bang was like this explosion, called expansion explosion, that should have made it so uniform. Well, how did we get these structures? So therefore, this, what they call this radiation, should have shown more lumpiness to it. In other words, more change in temperature is not enough there. Now, if you got that, fine. Otherwise, I know it's, I can just bog right down on that one alone. In other words, there's problems with the very radiation that we look at. It's not lumpy enough. And so we have to, by the way, get more dark matter involved with that. Okay, contradicting. Medium and heavy elements. Where do they come from? The nuclear synthesis theory is what they proposed. The problem is that the abundances aren't in the right ratios. I just have to leave it there. It's thick, okay? We already talked about star formation. Where does we even get the stars? Even if we had a Big Bang, and even if we had the matter, and we gave you all that hydrogen and helium, how can we get those first population 3 stars to actually form? How does it get? Nobody knows. Can't do it. Galaxy formation, the same thing. Why do we have all these different shaped galaxies, different spiral arms and different shapes and sizes to them and so on? Spiral galaxies mentioned. Okay, and then how about the distribution of the galaxies and the redshift? Now I'll talk about that distribution in a second and also the redshift. Okay, this is a little bit I'll give and then we'll just about get there. What does this redshift mean? When you look at the stars and the sun, they emit light. Most of it is white light. And when you put that through a prism, you get the rainbow of colors, right? So the white light is actually made up of from blue all the way to red light. Now we've been able to look then at Now if we take a look at stars that emit this light, it turns out if they move towards the Earth, we get what's called a compressed blue shift. In other words, literally the light is bluer than it should be from the original source. If the star is moving away, it gets what we call red shifted. That means, by the way, that literally the light itself, the wavelength of it, has been stretched in space. Space itself has been stretched. So it gets a longer wavelength, therefore it's going more red. So physics, right? Okay, so red shift then tells us that the universe in general is expanding because everything seems to be moving away. Everything we look at journey out there, we see all these stars, we see them red shifting on us, with, of course, a number of exceptions that are blue shifted, which create all kinds of havoc. Alright, so we have this idea of moving away. Fine. We all actually accept that. So it describes the expansion of the universe, and that's no problem to us because it even talks about God in Psalms, that he stretched out the heavens like a curtain. Interesting that he actually said it that way in a number of a few places. The idea of stretching of space. Okay, so it describes the expansion of the universe. And actually it helps us to tell the distance by inference of a galaxy from the Earth, and that's why we get this idea of how far out things are. I won't explain that to you. Okay, redshift interpretation. Okay, let's take a look at a galaxy. Now remember, Big Bang says that, roughly speaking, galaxies are uniformly distributed, roughly speaking, on a general mapping, they're distributed uniformly. What does that mean? Well, galaxy 1, a certain distance away, should have a certain shift of light. This is exaggerated, by the way. The second galaxy, being farther away, should be more redshifted. That's how they know. The farther away they are, the faster they move away from us, the farther away, therefore they're more redshifted. Keep doing that. Okay, so the farther away they are, the more redshifted. Good. So we should observe redshifts at all distances along the light spectrum according to the Big Bang model. We should observe all the way, because there's galaxies roughly all the way, evenly distributed as we move farther from the Earth. Alright, so what do we predict? Well, that's what I'm trying to show here. All these little redshifts. There should be just a whole distribution of evenly distributed roughly. What does the evidence show? What we actually observed is what we call quantized redshift. Well, there's only few and far between. This is oversimplified, but the idea is there. Statistically speaking, they are quantized in roughly 1 million light year intervals. You know what that means? It means this. If the redshift is true in that we're seeing this quantized redshift, it could only happen if we were at or near the center of the universe. Because we have to then have shells, or concentric shells, of galaxies outwardly from us at the center. Right? Like this. So it has to be in concentric circles, roughly with 1 million light years apart, on average. Okay? Has this been confirmed, and then what would it mean? Well, here's what it would mean. Russell Humphreys. Astronomers have confirmed that numerical values of galaxy redshift are quantized, tending to fall in distinct groups. That would mean that the galaxies tend to be grouped into conceptual spherical shells concentric around our home galaxy. By the way, Hubble has confirmed this, Napier and Guthrie. The redshift distribution has been found to be strongly quantized in the galactocentric frame of reference. Milky Way, galaxy-centered. What does this mean to the Big Bang? Here's what it means. The quantized distribution of galactic redshifts observed by various astronomers seems to contradict the very Copernican principle and all cosmologies founded on it, including the Big Bang. Big Bang does not work when you have a center to the universe. It has to be non-centered, no center anywhere, no edges to it at all. If it does, you got a problem. So you know what? The creationists then, which I won't have time, have gone into, Humphreys being one, and Dr. John Hartnett being another, where they're trying to answer some of these questions about why we see redshift and what do we, you know, the evidences that are out there. Is there a good creationist model that can fit? And they're basing theirs on that we were at and created at or near the center of the universe, and that there is a center, and that there is an edge, And they're basing their theories on that and come up with very interesting possibilities. Now, I could leave it there. So what we're going to do is this. The distant starlight problem was mentioned quickly, and I'll be done that. I'm not going to go into detail, but I have a lot more. All right, here's the problem. If the universe is as big as they say, you know what? They're so far apart that the light from the stars, if it was only a few thousand years, would never have had time to get here yet. So how do we see the very stars that are out there? Because we've measured them, by the way, and we can measure them out even by fairly direct means to thousands, many thousands of light years. So certainly older than the biblical time frame that we're talking about, a few thousand years, roughly 6,000 years. How does it get there? Well, here it is, right? There's the sun, a star, and the light shines on us. I've had those things up there. They actually work on this. See the things spin? There you go. All right. Got to notice this, though. It takes me a lot of work to do that, so you got to pick up on that. All right. By the way, this idea is also a problem for Big Banger. I say the Big Bangers because that's a big, you know, cosmic Big Bang thing. And they call it the horizon problem. I'm going to skip that for a second because I couldn't explain. They actually have exactly the same problem, and this is why they had to introduce their inflation theory to account for this problem. Right? It had to be adjusted, the whole theory. All right, possible solutions that we've come up with as creationists. Number one, the possibility that God simply created light on the way, a mature universe. Okay, let me go to a slide after that. Okay, I'll just hold that thought for a moment. Okay, another possibility is that the speed of light was faster in the past. If it was faster in the past, the idea that the light had time to get to us. Trouble is, Setterfield studied this, made observations, and I think they're more or less debunking it now. So statistically, we're not sure that the speed of light has been diminishing now, and there's other implications, so it's not in vogue, even in creationists right now. The possibility of asynchronous time theory, I'll just mention it because we want to study. Dr. Jason Lyles came up with this one, very interesting one, actually. I kind of got a kick of that. But two kind of interesting ones I studied in more detail are what we call time dilation theories. This is the idea that time as measured on Earth could vary when you go out to different places in the universe and the galaxy. So you noticed I used that the universe was created over roughly 6 solar days Earth standard time. And as a physics person, I know that time is a funny concept for us, right? But certainly it holds to the truth of the scripture and can possibly explain the idea of distant starlight getting to us. Just to go back, by the way, to that problem of the mature universe, it sounds good, and I'm still not, as well, totally rejecting it. Here's the problem. We have supernovae where we've seen stars actually explode. And the trouble is, if a star is several million light years away and it goes supernova and explodes, and now we see the light, think about that. That means that the stars, the supernovae, the light had to be created on the way without it really happening. So think about that for a minute, right? It underwent supernovae, you see the light come, wait a minute, this thing is sort of hundreds of millions of light years away, or several millions of light years away, doesn't matter, pick one. And you got a problem, because it hasn't supernovated in reality. It was created to look like it did. Is that a problem? Well, some will come up even as creation to say, well, not really. For example, if you look at Eve, who was created probably pretty mature, and you took a look at her hair, where you can actually look at the hair and look up at the proteins that make it up and look at her nutritional history, then she would probably have to have some kind of history involved. Think about that, right? Like, I mean, if we're created near mature, would it show signs of maturity? And you might have to say, well, maybe, yeah. I've often thought of things like, would trees, which you created instantly, have tree rings? Oh, I don't know. The thought, but I don't know all those answers totally. All he knows, God did it. And he could have made him, create him to look mature without being deceptive, is what I'm trying to get at. So some people say that, no, he could still have created everything we see, including that apparent supernovae, even though this light couldn't have come from how far away we say it was. Now, I skip about 40 slides here. Two good little, which I didn't forgot to mention to you, that two good books, actually, or videos, are Starlight and Time, if you're interested in this creationist cosmology, by Dr. Russell Humphreys. And the second one is Starlight, Time, and the New Physics. And this one is by Dr. John Hartnett. It's a more recent theory. And they're both rather interesting. Gives you food for thought. So for critical thinking, which is easier to believe? Nothing created something, in other words, the universe, or in the beginning, God created. So therefore, we believe that the Bible has the answers, and the creation by God gives meaning to the universe. Who created? What was created? How it was created? When it was created? And how long it took to create? And so I'd like to thank you for being patient with me with that. So we're done. Oops. Back to the